everybody, and welcome to Old Spook Lane, where we're going to be covering creepy topics here on Creepy Chats. I am Patricia, and I am here with Aaron Mehta from The Aaron Mehta Show.
Yeah, I believe this is our time of year,
Yes, it is. So if you guys remember last year, we decided to change Old School Lane into a more spookier direction in October with Old Spook Lane. And it seemed to have gotten a lot more people really enjoying it. They really liked the fact that we were covering more creepier topics on casual chats, especially since we would do like maybe one Halloween episode every single year. But this time around, we decided to do four, and we did have a lot of fun covering those. So for those who missed out on it, I'm actually going to create a playlist for all the previous episodes of Old Spook Lane Creepy Chats that we did last year. We did a hodgepodge of different topics, but this time around, we're actually going to be doing a theme on Old Spook Lane Creepy Chats. We're dedicating an entire month to Tim Burton.
And Tim Burton, I mean, like, do we really need to tell you who Tim Burton is on this channel? Like, you know, like on the Aaron and Patricia, like, you know, I'm pretty sure on various podcasts that we've done, whether it was, you know, were Disney related or whether it was like, you know, were, or, you know, were Halloween related or even Christmas related, even like, you know, Tim Burton has basically played a feature role in some of our discussions that we've had.
Yeah. So Tim Burton, for those who don't know, is a film director who is known for a distinctive style of combining the strange, spooky, and unusual into mainstream cinema. The first film that he ever directed was Pee-wee's Big Adventure. If you are interested in checking out our brief discussions on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, there's two ways you can check it out. I did a blog interview with Les from Manic Expression several years ago. I'll leave a link in the description box below. And also, we briefly covered it on our discussion of Pee-wee's Big Holiday. So yeah, I would say that if you want to get a gist of Tim Burton's first movie that he ever directed, then go check out those links in below and you can be able to find out my thoughts on Pee-wee's Big Adventure. But no,
by the
this
way, there's an interesting thing about Tim Burton, like some of our other discussions that we have, his childhood heroes were actually Dr. Seuss and Roald Dahl, would you believe?
Yeah, kind of funny considering that they both have this distinctive way of creating really strange stories, but at the same time having a way of spooking kids. I mean, whether it be with Dr. Seuss with the strange animals and the very serious stories, whether it be with, you know, don't pollute, or, you know, if you like certain things, it can turn out to be bad if you're not able to open up, or with Roald Dahl, whether it be with turning kids into mice, or you know, these awful looking creatures that hate each other, that basically just get squished to death, or, you know, all those things. Again, if you want to know about that, go check out the Roald Dahl retrospective. But no, Tim Burton, at the time in the 80s, he was this really rebellious director who had formerly worked in Disney. And then he left because he felt that, you know, Disney wasn't exactly able to give him the creative freedom that he wanted. And then he directed.
Doesn't that ring a bell?
I know, right? Don Bluth. He did two projects at the time. One was a short film called Frankenweenie, and the other one was a short called Vincent. And it was thanks to the person who was in Frankenweenie who decided to connect him with Paul Rubens, and that was where he decided to do Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And then after the success of that movie, then Tim Burton's career started to become more bankable for him. You know, before he was kind of like that director that they didn't even know what to do with him, to, oh wow, you know, he directed this movie based off of this pop culture phenomenon in the 80s. I think he can be able to bring some new life into cinema. And so we're going to be talking about his second film, and that is Beetlejuice, which premiered in 1988.
Yeah. So my first introduction to Beetlejuice back in the day, actually, funnily enough, wasn't the movie. It was actually the animated TV series, which I believe somewhere down the line we will talk about when we finally get hold of the DVDs. But anyway, until then. So, yeah, I had no idea that this, at the time when I was growing up, was actually, you know, a movie that was released by Tim Burton. And, you know, so I did watch it for the first time when I was a teenager, and then, you know, realized, oh, wow, it's so radically different from the cartoon show. You know, like.
Yeah, I'm the same thing. I was one of those people who was first introduced to the animated series as well, and then didn't watch Beetlejuice until a little bit later on. Not until I think that when I first saw both the movie and then I saw like an episode of the animated series, I felt like this huge juxtaposition. It's like, wow, this cartoon that I love and grew up with was based off of a movie that was clearly not for me at the time.
I'm pretty sure that's pretty, that's going to be a story that I think we hear throughout some of our listeners of this. Like, oh, hey, I was introduced to Rambo by the TV series. Hey, I was introduced to Mr. T through the TV series. Hey, I was introduced to RoboCop through the TV series. I think that's going to be a lot of kids, discussions, when it comes to, oh, hey, this is how I ended up at the movie, because I found out there was actually a cartoon show or there was something that was an offshoot of it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how the 80s and 90s they were able to make a lot of rated R movies into animated series for kids. There was obviously Beetlejuice, there was Rambo, there was Karate Kid, there was Toxic Crusaders. They were almost attempting on doing an Aliens animated series, and they even had the toys in production, but that never happened.
I
So
think the only time when I saw that there was actually like a reverse of this trend is that when when The Mask came out by with Ke starring Ke Jim Carrey, and then after that the animated series came out after that, and same with Ace Ventura as well. Like a lot of people are already familiar with Ace Ventura, or before the animated series came out. So I think when we came out to, like, towards the late 90s, I think they were starting to become like a bit of a reverse trend. Everybody was aware of these movies already, and there seemed to be a bit more awareness about the fact that these properties existed long before they had their animated counterparts.
yeah, it could either go in one or two directions. It can be somewhat close to the original source material, like, say, maybe Rambo or RoboCop, or it can go into a completely different direction, like, say, Toxic Crusaders, Mighty Ducks, or Beetlejuice.
Yeah, I think one thing to kind of point out is that, well, Beetlejuice itself was a massive success. Keep this in mind, like, it was released in 1988, so obviously success, quote unquote, is obviously very different from the success you probably say today, where it has like $1 billion at the box office. To this movie was made on a $15 million budget, pulled in about $74 million worldwide.
Yeah,
So in that
and it was
instance, it
like,
was a success. But
yeah, and I
here's
was
the thing
like,
about this. The one thing I would say that makes this quite surprising is that while this movie was a success and won quite a few awards, it's taken only until May 10th of 2023 that they actually announced the sequel. So
well,
like several decades after that.
the reason why is because they were planning on doing another sequel to Beetlejuice, like way around the early 90s. If you remember, there was an announcement about that Tim Burton and Michael Keaton were planning on doing a sequel to Beetlejuice called Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. And then that project was in developmental hell for several decades until eventually they decided to scrap the idea. And now we're going to be getting the new sequel that's going to be coming out next year, which is not derived from Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
I did forget about that actually. Like if that's almost it's funny. Like this feels like a massive revisit for me in regards to Beetlejuice because besides the original movie, besides the animated TV series, I mean, I've not really been keeping my finger on the pulse when it comes to the Beetlejuice franchise. So I have no besides those two items, I have no idea about everything else that's outside of that really.
Yeah, and the only reason why I'm familiar with the Beetlejuice musical was because several years ago, Matthew Klickstein worked on the documentary On Your Mark. And for those who don't know, On Your Mark was based off of the the life and career of Mark Summers, the host of Double Dare. Lo and behold, one of the producers of that documentary project was Alex Brightman, and he would be the main Broadway actor for Beetlejuice for several years. So I actually knew that there was going to be a Beetlejuice musical at least 3 years before it even came out. Yeah, so I have not seen the Beetlejuice musical, and I really want to because I've heard a lot of great things about it. But
Yeah. Anyway,
unfortunately,
before we get into that, I mean, obviously there is Beetlejuice itself for the subject matter to getting hold of. So,
okay, let's do that.
okay then. So, this movie takes place in Winter River, Connecticut. So, where Barbara and Adam Madeline decide to spend their vacation decorating their idyllic country home. They are driving home on the trip from a trip through the town. Barbara swerves to avoid a dog, and the car plunges into the river. After returning home, she and Adam notice that they now lack reflections and find a handbook for the recently deceased. They begin to suspect that they did not survive the car accident. When Adam attempts to leave the house, course, he ends up in a strange and otherworldly desert-like landscape populated by enormous sandworms. The encounter lasts only a few seconds for him, but after being rescued by Barbara, she claims that he was gone for over 2 hours. The house is sold, and the new owners, the Dietz family, arrive from New York City. Charles Dietz is a former real estate developer, and the second wife, Dahlia, is the self-proclaimed sculptor, and his teenage goth daughter, Lydia, from his first marriage, is an aspiring photographer. Under the guidance of the interior designer, Otho, the family transforms the house into a pastel-toned work of postmodern art. Consulting the handbook, the Madelines travel to an otherworldly waiting room, populated by other distressed souls, where they discover the afterlife is structured according to a complex bureaucracy involving vouchers and caseworkers. The Madelines' caseworkers, Juno, informs them that they must remain in the house for the next 125 years on the plane of a dire fate. If they want the deeds out of the house, it's up to the Madelines to scare them away. So that's basically the start of the movie. And so, I mean, right off the bat, I mean, like, you're introduced to all sorts of wacky characters in all of this. And dare I say, like, Barbara and Adam are pretty fun in themselves, even when they realize that they're dead.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, the one thing that I really like about this movie is that it lets your guard down. You have this perfect small town in Connecticut where, you know, the neighbors are friendly and everything is just so clean and put together. And you have this loving couple who decide to have a staycation together for 2 weeks. And you have the scenario.
It makes you wonder, though, like, when you say that, I mean, you know, it makes you wonder if they should have gone full force with it. Like, you know, maybe they should have, like, because, you know, from the get-go, like, when you see the credits and when you, like, the intro credits and you see, like, you know, the intro graphic, you know what you're in for, effectively.
I mean, at the time, you know, at the time, I'm sure that, you know, they probably didn't even expect to see all the craziness and wackiness that Beetlejuice would offer. I mean, today we know this because it's become a pop culture phenomenon, but I'm sure at the time, Tim Burton was only known for Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and yeah, it had its sense of realism and wackiness, but it was more towards the sense of realism because, you know, Pee-wee would, you know, be riding around across the country to look for his bike, and he would meet up with strange characters along the way, but they were not in the supernatural unless it was in his dreams. So yeah, this is like the first time that we would see full force on what Tim Burton is able to do with combining like the everyday mixed with the crazy and the strange.
Yeah, but it makes you wonder, like, maybe they should probably go like in that direction, because if you remember, you know, where Monsters, Inc., you know, that 2003 movie, they originally were going to go with, like, you know, the bedroom scaring scene, you know, where they were like training in that, and then it would all be kind of come as elaborate. So they realized that that's kind of like, you know, took away the, like, you know, the comedic intro of, like, you know, what Monsters, Inc. was supposed to be. So that's the reason why they ended up putting in, like, you know, the 2D, you know, intro that they started off with, if you remember. So I think it makes me wonder, like, if they really wanted to go full force, like putting people, like, you know, in a state of unease, maybe they probably should have started off somewhat like that, where, like, you know, the music isn't like, you know, the Beetlejuice intro. It's like, it's, you know, it's all happy and nice, and, like, you know, there's it kind of like the Carpenters, if you will, like that type of thing. And then all the intro would come in, and then after that, you then start to feel uneasy as you start going further through into the movie.
You know, interesting.
So, even like the credits, even the text that they use for the credits, even looks like something out of Ghostbusters.
I guess that's true. Yeah. You have this annoying neighbor who is just constantly forcing them to sell the house because she thinks that a family would be more suited for them because, oh, you know, just these two people living in this large house. I mean, what are you going to do with that? So, yeah, I think that, you know, with seeing the neighborhood, and by the way, this is the only time that we ever get to see the entire neighborhood. After this, it's mostly in the house. And you would think that you'd be completely bored and you would have sensory deprivation because they're just located in just this one house. They don't go outside. They're not able to, you know, see the human world. But then everything changes once they're dead. And then we get to see the supernatural world. We get to see the desert with the sandworms. We get to be able to see the office of the recently deceased. We get to be able to see the model coming into a larger scale. So It plays to his advantage because you would think that you're going into one direction, but then you're just in a complete 180 going to another one. And
yeah, but I think the one thing I would say is that you're sort of expecting it, aren't you? After
yeah,
like,
you're expecting it now, yeah. Yes. But at the time, I'm sure that for audiences who are seeing this movie for the first time, I'm sure it just like took them like completely off the loop. It almost kind of reminds me of when...
Well, I think from one aspect, I think you could say that, oh, hey, look at this nice couple. Like, you know, really nothing bad happens to them. Like, you know, they've got their whole lives ahead of them. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, they drown. You know,
mm-hmm.
like,
yeah.
so I guess maybe from that aspect, I guess you could say, yeah, people are probably taken aback a little bit by that.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of
being taken aback by that. You know,
yeah,
that
it kind of reminds me of when Psycho first came out in 1960, and you had Alfred Hitchcock, who didn't want anybody to know that Vivian Leigh was going to die in the first act because it was promoted that she was going to be the main star. And so he actually locked the theater doors on purpose so that if anybody showed up late, they weren't able to come in at all so that they'll be confused. It's like, wait a minute, where's Vivian Leigh? So yeah, it brings into that plot twist about like, oh, wow, she actually gets killed off in the first act. So I guess for people who didn't know what to expect when going into Beetlejuice, it's like, wait a minute, now they're dead? So that just gets you intrigued about like, okay, what's going to be happening next?
Well, I think when they go on the first scene where like they came in, like they're all dripping wet and stuff. And mind you, the one thing that they do is to kind of like impound that is that all of a sudden, you know, the fireplace starts up by itself. And then the, you know, then you see like the book appear and it's like, oh, hey, that, you know, something is definitely not right is going on here. But, you know, characters who were first introduced to Barbara and Adam, they're not aware of that yet.
No, they're not aware of that.
I mean, I think there is an instance though that the audience is kind of catching on to like what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing that we see other than just them dripping wet and walking home is that there's no footprints. And also when they walk into the fireplace, it's like, wait a minute, we didn't start this fire.
You know what? I never noticed that, actually. That's a good point. You know, the only thing I noticed is that, you know, when she brought the horse like in front of the mirror and like you can only see the horse and nobody else.
Oh, yeah. The reflection. Yeah. So,
oh, wow. I totally missed out on that. Wow. Okay, then.
Yeah.
And by the way, we watched the 4K version.
Yeah. And it looks great, by the way. Yeah, this is. I would say that for a movie that came out in 1988, the effects, I would say, I mean, it is obvious of what's real and what's not. I mean, you can definitely tell when some parts are made of clay or when some parts are made of, you know, like, you know, made models and stuff like that. That is a parody. But I would say,
but again, that's the style of the time, you know, like, you know, like, again, you know, going back to, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know, like, you look at, Large Marge now, and you could think, oh, wow, that's just, you know, plasticine all kind of stuck together and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's the way they did graphics at the time. Like, I get there's probably like, various, you know, updates that people have done, like some movies, like, you know, back in the day to like make them look a bit more like, you know, real. But you know, you can tell that's the great thing I think about Beetlejuice. I think what makes it, you know, a really nice nostalgic piece, which is that, you know, you can see like all the time and effort they went in to make, you know, make the practical effects of the movie.
Yeah, and I think that's what James Rolfe, every time that he does an episode of Cinemassacre's Monster Madness, yeah, where he would always talk about like in the 80s they used to do practical effects. Today is everything is CGI. They don't make movies like this anymore. So I guess when you see Beetlejuice and you see that everything that was done in effects was made with practical effects and with no CGI, it just makes it even more impressive by today's standards.
Yeah, and by the way, anyone who's not really happy with CGI right now, like, you know, wait till AI comes into the movies. Yeah, we're not in a good place then after that.
I guess not.
I tell you what, it's gonna give more appreciation for movies like Beetlejuice, I think, you know, the way that cinema seems to be going.
Yeah, I just really love the fact that when you expect to see something like spooky, you would think like, okay, you have ghosts, okay. Are they just gonna like haunt a house? Or are they just going to be like possessing people? And they do, but they do it in a comedic way. Whereas something along the lines of Poltergeist or The Exorcist was able to put it into like something like really serious and scary, but they're able to make a twist into it. It's like, this is supposed to be funny. It's scary, yes, but it also makes you laugh, which I think is not very easy to pull off.
I think what's great about it is that, you know, what if you had like a ghost in a house that was not very good at his job? And like, this movie, like, you know, it just, it's and dare I, you know, dare I say, it's way better than like, you know, anything that scary movies put together, like in the last, you know, the last 100 movies that they've released.
Yeah, so pretty
like,
much.
It's like, it's just, it's I like this concept. I like the idea of like, here's these ghosts that are useless. You know, basically, like, you know, they're trying their best to, like, you know, get scare the people out of the house, but everything that seems to do is either seen as, like, you know, a novelty, or it seems to have done as comedic, or they're not aware of, like, their surroundings around them. So of course it's gonna, you know, go unnoticed, because obviously, you know, it's only one person who's Lydia who can actually see them compared to everybody else in there. So yeah, I like this idea that, you know, they are trying, you can see that they're trying their hardest, but unfortunately it just doesn't come through.
And the reason why it doesn't come through is because they're so preoccupied. You have the Dietz family, which consists of Charles, who is a real estate developer, Delia, who is a sculptor, and Lydia, who is into like goth and strange and dark things. So yeah, I would expect for somebody like Lydia to be able to see Barbara and Adam, because she is into the strange and unusual, and she was able to read through the handbook really easily. Whereas for Barbara and Adam, they couldn't be able to comprehend it. So, I mean, I really love the Dietz family. I mean, they're just this prime example of just this awful, presumptuous and, you know, stuck up family that you would expect to see in the 80s. I mean, like around that time of the 80s, you had the yuppies, where they were just all about business. And it perfectly aligns with, you know, the kind of characters that we would see back then, in which they all, the only thing they care about was
but only the perfect folly for Barbara and Adam. When you think about it, like, you know, it's just, it's they are a family of, like, also just a bunch of eccentrics themselves. Like, you know, you got the overworked, you know, father figure, and then you've got the mother who's like lives in her own world, and, you know, basically just trying to take control of everything, you know, very, very control freak. Then you got Lydia, who, like, is just like, you know, the outcast pretty much, and is the person who, you know, it definitely fits the bill of like someone who could talk to ghosts, because she doesn't see herself as pretty much alive. You know, she's pretty much half dead in this movie.
Yeah, pretty much. And she always dresses up like she's going to a funeral.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, these are a bunch of weirdos who have walked into a haunted house. And, you know, whether it would have been like, you know, you see movies now where, like, haunted movies where, you know, it's a bunch of teenagers who are, like, completely dislikable, and, like, you know, the killer goes around and kills them all one by one and stuff like that, Friday the 13th. Or, you know, where you have, like, a movie where it's, like, it's a nice little family who, like, you know, doesn't want any trouble, and all of a sudden the ghost comes in to haunt them, like, you know, for unknown reasons, and, you know, you really do feel for them. In this case, I mean, it's kind of like the reverse. You kind of feel for the ghosts, not for the people occupying the house.
Yeah, this isn't like Poltergeist, in which, you know, the family is really nice, but then all of a sudden this whole place is completely haunted and they're affected by it. And it's not like a slasher movie like Friday the 13th, in which you hate these characters and you're rooting for the killer to kill them off because they were awful. But yeah, I would say that this is a really nice reverse, in which you actually are rooting for the ghost to kick off this family, because this family is already really weird and strange, and they completely changed the house, and they are trying to get, you know, scare them away so that they can be able to get their house back to normal, because they're going to be stuck there for 125 years anyway.
Yeah, I guess our somewhat villain in this movie, I guess, is Otho, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, kind of interesting about how a lot of people would think that, oh, Beetlejuice is the main bad guy. Well, he kind of is, but Otho, I would say, is the one that's kind of like leading in towards villainy, at least towards the third act. You think about him as like this, oh, you know, I am this interior designer, and I think that this is going to be the best for everybody. He's just into himself. And, you know, he clearly is like trying to lead Delia into doing a whole bunch of things. And then eventually he starts picking up on the supernatural stuff, which he claims that he's just as passionate about as interior decorating. And, you know, he's essentially the one that pretty much just leads into convincing Delia, hey, you know, this could be an opportunity for us to make this haunted house marketable. So in a way, he's kind of like leading the strings into eventually, you know, all the crazy stuff that's going to be happening throughout the course of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can talk about Beetlejuice himself, I guess, at this point.
Oh yeah,
like,
let's do so.
I mean, here's the thing about this, like, you know, in a way, he is a villain in this movie. I mean, obviously, he does some like really horrendous and awful things. Then we go, by the way, this movie would never fly in the Me Too era. It would never, like, you know, you can definitely tell this is a product of its time, like, you know, the perverse, you know, nature of Beetlejuice as well. But I mean, putting those dated tropes aside, I mean, the one thing I would say is that I mean, Beetlejuice is basically just anarchy. Like, if he's undead anarchy, like, he doesn't really understand, like, this idea of, like, a rule structure or, like, anything else. And even, Juno at the very beginning says, like, oh, you do not want to be messing around with this guy because he used to be my assistant and he basically was just crazy. And he just wanted to, like, do, like, all, like, these bioexorcists and stuff like that. And he went away basically thinking he could do whatever he wants. And so, like, he's unchecked anarchy in this. And so it's in a way, of course, they're not saying that he shouldn't take responsibility for his actions. Of course he does, and eventually he ends up getting his comeuppance. But at the same time, you can sort of understand in his character why he doesn't, like, when he does things, you can see that he's not thinking anything through. Like, he doesn't see things from another point. He lacks a third eye effectively in this situation. So of course he's just going to be crazy and he's going to do things without thinking, and he is basically going to be our anarchist in this movie effectively.
Yeah, and he tries to convince Barbara and Adam that he was going to be the one to scare everybody, but then they decide, no, this guy is too crazy. Let's just try to do it ourselves. And then he tries to take matters into his own hands when Otho decides to resurrect Barbara and Adam from the dead. And then Lydia goes over to Beetlejuice begging him to, bring them back to life. And so he's like, yeah, I could do that if you get married to me. So yeah, I mean, like he's a kind of guy
Which is kind
who
of creepy in itself, because how old's Lydia in this movie?
she's like, what, like 13 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Again, it's an 80s product, like I this is the thing. A lot of things that you see in Beetlejuice probably would not fly today. They just wouldn't.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, like the constant kissing and the groping and checking on Barbara's underwear and the fact that he grabbed his crotch and he yelled out, "Nice fucking model." Yeah, that kind of stuff would not. Oh, and don't forget about the don't forget about the brothel that just so happens to be right in the middle of the model of the
Oh yeah,
entire
which Juno
town.
built to catch to catch Beetlejuice and, like, and trap him in that. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's just it's so what. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of stuff in here that just wouldn't fly today. Like, it's gonna be interesting to see, because obviously there's gonna be a sequel to this movie now. And I mean, given the fact that a lot of times have changed, I mean, like, how is I mean, keep in mind, the sequel usually has to end up having to kind of, like, top the original. How's it gonna do that? Like, if this is the material it's got to work with.
It's got to be creative. That's the thing. They're
Yeah,
going to
that's the
have to,
thing.
yeah,
Yeah,
they're
they're
going to
gonna have
have to
to.
work. They're going to have to work around the fact that there are some things that cannot be done today. So I'm sure that they can be able to be creative on it because if Beetlejuice is very successful as a musical, I'm sure that they'll create something that'll be able to
I mean, here's
retroact.
the thing about this. I've not seen Beetlejuice the musical, so I don't know how faithful it is to, like, the movie adaptation. So, but I mean, the problem is that they could bring Beetlejuice back, but then they realize it's kind of the same way that people try to bring Duke Nukem back. It's kind of like, oh yeah, you can see it. See, like, he was kind of cool in the 90s when he's, like, seeing, like, all these catchphrases and, like, being a doing all this stuff, but you kind of realize why he's kind of, like, not really relevant in 2023,
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. That's something we're going to be talking about next year. Yeah, but in the meanwhile, I think that Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice is absolutely just amazing. The fact that he was able to play around with being really serious about his job, but at the same time, just being really manic and crazy and just scaring people for fun and just being this absolute pervert. I mean, he was able to like mix all of these characters together, like almost a character that has like multiple personality syndrome and able to just put them all together. I mean, that would be annoying if not done right. And Michael Keaton just hits it right out of the park.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing I'll say about Michael Keaton's performance of Beetlejuice, I think is really good in the way that he just captures, his character so well. And it makes you wonder, like, I mean, I would have loved to have seen, like, the test screenings for, like, sorry, like, the test using for, like, Beetlejuice when they were, like, first, like, coming up with the concept, and him, like, being in the makeup and, like, doing, like, I just seem like do ad lib, if anything, in this character. I think it'd be really good to watch.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to watch, and especially since there were other people who were planning on being Beetlejuice, but when Tim Burton saw Michael Keaton's performance, he was sold. Imagine Sammy Davis Jr., Dudley Moore, and Sam Kinison as Beetlejuice. That would have been a really interesting alternative universe we would have been living in.
Who knows? Like, imagine to see, like, if they did do the sequel inside, like, oh hey, let's bring all these guys back and, like, like, say, let's do, like, various versions of Beetlejuice, like, like he's like, that when with Buck in Ice Age, when, like, you know, he has these all variations, like, in his head. Maybe they could have done, like, a scene with that where, like, you know, there's, like, various versions of, like, Beetlejuice, like, all kind of, like, you know, that different, have, like, a scene like that. That'd be kind of cool to watch. But,
Interesting.
yeah.
Yeah, and I think that you know, I mean, not just Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice is fantastic, but I would argue that the entire cast is really great.
Well, I mean, you got Alec Baldwin from, like, you know, back in the back when all back when his hair was his natural color, you know. But yeah, like, so that's kind of jarring to think about. Like, that was Alec Baldwin back in the day.
We know him for, you know, various other roles nowadays, like 30 Rock and stuff like that. But just to see him in that role is just like, oh yeah, that was Alec Baldwin back in the day.
And also, yeah, Gina Davis is also in this movie, so.
Yeah, and this was like after she did The Fly. If you remember, that was that reboot of the 50s movie that had her and Jeff Goldblum in it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I guess this wouldn't be like a drastic change because that movie was scary. It was essentially, you know, a guy turning into a fly. So I guess this would be kind of like fitting into it just fine. And I think that Winona Ryder does a really good job. This was like one of her
Yeah,
earlier
actually,
roles
that's
that
the
she
one
was
thing I
in.
would say. If you're going to be dealing with a Tim Burton movie, don't be too surprised if Winona Ryder is not too far behind. So,
Yeah, that's true. And that's the thing is that this would be the beginning of Tim Burton using the same people over and over again. He brought back Danny Elfman to do the music. He would bring back Michael Keaton several times, obviously for the Batman movies. He would bring back Geoffrey Jones for Ed Wood, and yeah, he would use you know, essentially, you know, his favorite actors over and over again. I remember we even had a discussion about this when we were talking about Wes Anderson, in which he would bring back the same people over and over again, and we even said that as long as they were able to fit to the character, then I don't mind if the same director cast the same actors if they're able to play it off differently than the previous movie that they were in.
the one thing I would say that, you know, in a way, you know, some directors obviously will keep going back to certain, you know, Quentin Tarantino goes back to Samuel L. Jackson, you know, quite a few times, you know,
Yeah,
in a certain part of the season. Yeah,
and Martin Scorsese always goes back to Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio.
exactly. Yeah, I mean, like, there's a reason why directors go back to, like, some of their people, like, you know, in their other you know, roles, because obviously they can trust them with, like, you know, with their material, and also see their creative image as well. So, like, you know, of course they're going to go back to these people time and time again, you know.
Yeah.
And also, they're great actors too, so of course you're going to go back to them, you know. So,
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that they were able to pull it off very well. I mean, you can believe that these are the characters in the movie. They're not just like, oh, they're the actors who are trying to play as a character and all you just see are the actors. You actually believe that they are the people that they're portraying in the movie.
and so I would say that only everybody who is in the cast of Beetlejuice, I mean, obviously they nail it down to a T,
Absolutely,
effectively.
yeah.
Like, you know, that's one thing I definitely say about this whole, you know, everyone that they got into this movie, I think, did it 100% correct. And you know, I can't say there was one you know, character in this movie that I could say, well, maybe they could have gone in this direction, maybe they could have gone in that direction. No, I think they've done it all perfectly well, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And the music fits in so perfectly. Like, we know Danny Elfman did really good on producing the movie for Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but he went all out for doing the music for Beetlejuice. It fits in so perfectly of the wackiness, the scariness, and the, you know, the quiet, mellow atmosphere. It just works so well.
Yeah, and I mean, he can go both ways. I mean, like, he can, you know, you saw him before, like, you know, putting in people in a false sense of security. Like, you know, the music obviously plays to that, and then eventually, as things start to get more surreal, the music starts to pull into that direction, and then, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, it'll put you into a false sense of security again, and then all of a sudden, you start, like, getting, like, you know, a musical, like, you know, haunting that we got with, like, you know, all the characters, like, you know, what was that song they were all dancing to?
Oh, Adeo, the Banana Boat song
A
by
Day
Harry
About.
Belafonte. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, all of a sudden, like, you know, the music just plays down, and that suddenly kicks in. Like, you know, the music in this movie is actually it was really good at, like, you know, taking the audience for a ride, along with the visuals.
Yeah. And I thought it was really interesting that they were able to include two songs from Harry Belafonte into a movie that's supposed to be like wacky and strange because, you know, usually those kind of songs would be party songs, they're calypso
I would argue
songs.
that, you know, yeah, but that's wacky and strange, don't you think? Like, what's a
Yeah.
Calypso song doing here? That's
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's true. Yeah.
out of the comfort zone.
Yeah, I
So
guess
yeah,
that's
I think,
true.
yeah, no, I think they did that right. I mean, like, it's you know, you could probably put, like, any wacky song, I think, in that situation, you know, to kind of, like, you know, where to. It even works in The Mask. Like, you remember, like, you know, when they did the, you know, the Calypso, you know, scene in all of
Oh yeah,
that,
that's right.
where,
When
like,
they
you
were
know,
in
there.
the when they were in the club.
I mean, yeah. Obviously it was played differently. Like, you know, this was played like, you know, because obviously it's the mask, you know, obviously it's, you know, it's Jim, you know, it's Stanley Ipkiss is like, you know, alter ego effectively coming out in like, you know, the most, you know, spectacular way. But I mean, like I would say like, you know, if you execute it correctly, it can really work to advantage. And then all of a sudden people walk out of the theater. It's like, oh, well, I'll remember that scene for like decades. And I'll even be telling other people about it. Which is why it makes this movie so great. And that's this is another, you know, scene that is like, oh, my God, I can't, that just happened, you know?
Exactly. Like you, I mean, the dinner scene is definitely one of the highlights of the movie where, you know, they're just sitting down. They're just talking about like, oh, there's ghosts in the house. It's like, oh, no, they're not. There's no ghosts in the house. Then all of a sudden they're possessed. They're singing the Banana Boat song. You would think that they're going to be running off screaming because they, you know, Barbara and Adam possessed them. But no, they're just having the time of their lives. It's like, no, we need to bring that main real estate guy from New York and see if they can be able to make this town into like a huge $1 billion conglomerate. Let's just now that was great. It's like they were loving it,
and that was makes them like the greatest follies to like, you know, Barbara and Adam, the fact that these people are so eccentric and so out of touch and like just like, you know, they are so focused like in their own little world. Like, you know, even Arthur is like, you know, even supposed to be like, you know, just involved in real estate, like, you know, he's got himself obsessed with like paranormal activity, like, you know, as a side thing. So yeah. Like, you know, it's just they are like, you know, the absolute foils for like, you know, Barbara and Adam in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they feel like they're so desperate to call Beetlejuice into helping, but then they realize, no, Beetlejuice would cause even more trouble than, you know, than trying to do it themselves, because we have that scene that follows them where Beetlejuice turns into a snake and almost kills them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think that the fact that they were able to go with peaks and bounds into this movie where it starts off really, really slow and then it just jumps all over the place, it's a great ride. It is a fantastic, exhilarating experience.
Yep.
Yeah, so I think that the movie was able to end it off pretty well, where they were able to decide, hey, you know, we know that you used to formerly live in this house. We don't want to see all of these creepy things happening anymore. Let's just see if we can just get along and be friends.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it actually leaves on quite a nice note, which makes me wonder, given the fact that we're going to be heading towards a sequel, and I get that, you know, the original concept for the sequel is going to be dramatically different. I'm guessing that, you know, this is, I guess, maybe when we get the sequel, maybe it's going to be pretty, you know, different as well.
Maybe. I mean, the only thing that we know so far is that Michael Keaton is returning as Beetlejuice and Winona Ryder will be returning as Lydia. And she's going to have a daughter who's going to be almost very similar to Lydia from the first movie, which makes a lot of sense because Jenny Ortega was able to become a huge sensation after she did Wednesday. So, yeah, that's the only thing we know of it so far. We don't know the storyline. We just know it's going to be coming out next year. So probably within maybe the next year or so, we'll get a trailer. Yeah, and if this writer strike is done, then maybe we can talk about it in Aaron and Patricia and give you our further thoughts into this.
That's still a thing, by the way, as of this podcast. So we might not be talking for this about a Beetlejuice sequel for even a while longer from the looks of things. So.
Yeah, because they still haven't been able to come up with a solution for everybody to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but yeah, this movie became a huge success. It won several Oscars for the makeup and for, you know, Best Supporting Actress from the lady who played as Juno, Sylvia Sidney. And also, this became a major part in, you know, Tim Burton stepping up as like a major mainstream actor. A year later, he would do Batman. Yes, Pee-wee's Big Adventure was able to have Tim Burton walk, and then Beetlejuice was able to have him run. So we kind of have to thank this movie for putting Tim Burton into the mainstream.
And in regards to accolades, I mean, so it's Beetlejuice won an Academy Award for Best Makeup. And
it deserved it.
Definitely does. Also, it was nominated for Best Visuals and Makeup as well in the 42nd British Academy Film Awards in the BAFTA. So I think Beetlejuice definitely is recognized in cinema as like, you know, being, you know, definitely something that people should check out. And you know, I think even to this day, I think, you know, where there's a lot of people who say, oh yeah, Beetlejuice, like I remember that movie from back in the 80s, and it left a profound impact on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now we're just waiting on the sequel to see if it's going to be able to strike the same lightning twice.
Mm-hmm. Well, until then, I guess we'll have to wait.
I guess we're going to be continuing on with our Tim Burton month. We're not going to be talking about Batman because obviously, you know, that's not much of a horror movie. But the next time we're going to be coming into old Spook Lane Creepy Chats, we're going to be talking about Edward Scissorhands.
But until then, I guess we're calling it a podcast.
All right, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye.